I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, the Supreme Court considers the Second Amendment right to bear arms. But first to presidential politics and this morning's speech on race by Democratic candidate Barack Obama.
Some commentators have deemed me either too black or not black enough. We saw racial tensions bubble to the surface during the week before the South Carolina primary. And yet, it's only been in the last couple of weeks that the discussion of race in this campaign has taken a particularly divisive turn.
Today's speech follows the controversy over comments made by the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, Obama's former and longtime pastor at the Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago. Among the inflammatory statements Reverend Wright made in his sermons, he called the September 11th tax retribution for U.S. foreign policy. Well, Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, is in Philadelphia. He covered the Obama speech as he's covered the campaign. Richard, your first impression?
Well, my first impression is just what a gutsy move it was to have this speech at all. I remember in 2000 how much praise then-Governor Bush got for saying one line about race, about how the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln, had not always carried his mantle. And here you have, obviously, a candidate of a very different complexion in many ways, really confronting this hot-button very emotional issue head-on, and doing it in both personal terms and also striking some really important historical themes, drawing in his own story and his campaign story together. So it was an extraordinary moment in a very extraordinary campaign.
Well, in fact, let's listen to some more. Barack Obama said again today that the comments made by Reverend Wright express a profoundly distorted view of America, but Obama also sought to explain how, at the same time, Wright is a part of his family and part of who he is and other people that he accepts despite their words. Let's listen.
I can no more disown him than I can disown my white grandmother, a woman who helped raise me, a woman who sacrificed again and again for me, a woman who loves me as much as she loves anything in this world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of black men who passed her by on the street, and who on more than one occasion has uttered racial or ethnic stereotypes that made me cringe. These people are part of me, and they are part of America, this country that I love.
Richard Wolff, some analysts before today's speech had said this is the last thing Barack Obama wants, an injection of race into the presidential race. It seemed as if he was eager to, you know, let's do it. Let's talk.
Right. And by all accounts, from his senior aides, this was a speech that he wrote. Normally when politicians are supposed to have written their speeches, everyone sort of takes it with a grain of salt. But this is something he wanted to do coming off of his TV interviews on Friday night as this story really gained steam. And he worked at it through the weekend, even into the early hours of this morning. So this is his words, his sentiments, and as you heard in that clip, this is his story. And I think that was actually a rather striking moment, not just talking about his pastor and his controversial comments, but about racism within his own white family. And again, this very deft move from the personal to the political and even the patriotic is something that has defined Barack Obama's rhetoric, not just in this campaign cycle, but going back to his breakthrough moment in 2004.
But Richard Wolff, how is this speech going to be received by the white voters for whom he seemed to be trying to reach out? He spoke of condemning the words of his former pastor, but then in explaining them, is that going to be seen by some as apologizing, making an apology for them?
Well, he addressed that head-on in the speech as well. He said some people are going to be taking this as making excuses, and it's not, because he said it was a full condemnation. But the question of how white voters see it is in some ways shaped by how we in the media report it. The truth is that while we have been very eager to say that the country is divided racially, and that has been true in places like Mississippi most recently in terms of the vote, it's also true that Barack Obama has won in overwhelmingly white states where there are really no significant people or numbers of people of color, such as Wyoming or even in Iowa. So how we report on this story also affects how people react to it.
And yet, as we know, polls have shown that he's been hurt by revelation of some of Reverend Wright's statements. And by the way, you used the word I was searching for. You wonder if some white voters might think that he's excusing what some saw as incredibly inflammatory words from his former pastor when he tried to put them in a context of generations of discrimination against blacks. But he also talked about a spectrum of anger. Without naming her, put Geraldine Ferraro on the other end of the spectrum, someone who said his candidacy is merely affirmative action, as he said. And he referred to anger in the white community as well. Let's listen.
In fact, a similar anger exists within segments of the white community. Most working and middle-class white Americans don't feel that they've been particularly privileged by their race. Their experience is the immigrant experience. As far as they're concerned, no one handed them anything. So when they are told to bus their children to a school across town, when they hear an African American is getting an advantage in landing a good job or a spot in a good college because of an injustice that they themselves never committed, when they're told that their fears about crime in urban neighborhoods are somehow prejudiced, resentment builds over time.
So, Richard Wolff, a real olive branch to there to all Americans, you know, on either side of a spectrum who may feel angry and frustrated. Do you think in giving this speech, and let's face it, most Americans don't hear it, they're going to hear portions of it.
Right.
What do you think the outcome's going to be? Is this going to put Reverend Wright and his comments behind Barack Obama or open up a whole new discussion?
Well, I think it definitely opens up a new discussion. Look, a good, successful politician takes these moments of crisis and turns them into an opportunity. And you could play the bits where he is telling the story about anger and frustration and resentment from the black perspective and the white perspective, which is what we've just been talking about. But that speech closes out talking about how children in failing schools are everybody's children, white, black, Latino, Asian, everyone. And that is a very powerful message and an organizing principle for his campaign. So the extent to which he can change the direction of this conversation, that he can build momentum out of what has obviously been a very rough couple of weeks for him and his campaign, that's going to be the test of his candidacy. And whether this speech moves it on or not, in some ways, really is about connecting with people and connecting with an audience that goes beyond what we've seen on cable news for the last several days.
Right. As he says, just as black anger often proved counterproductive, so have white resentments distracted attention from the real culprits of the middle class squeeze, and going on to list some of the serious problems in America that aren't getting addressed because of the other debates. Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, speaking from Philadelphia, where Barack Obama spoke earlier today. Richard, thanks as always.
Thank you.
A well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. Well, so reads the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Were the framers intending to protect an individual's right to bear arms, or the collective rights of a militia, or an individual's right to keep arms in case they might one day need to be in a militia? A landmark case argued before the Supreme Court today considered that question. In the District of Columbia versus Heller, a challenge to Washington, D.C.'s 32-year-old ban on handguns, it could lead to changes in gun laws across the country. Lyle Denniston of SCOTUSblog.com was in the courtroom during arguments, which wrapped up just before noon East Coast time. Lyle, the last time the Supreme Court took this question up was in 1939. That court ruled that the amendment refers to militias. So, first of all, this is historic. Describe the scene there today.
Well, for 2 days now, or nearly 2 days, there has been a line outside the courtroom of people hoping to get one of the few seats available for public seating in the courtroom. Once the argument began, I didn't see one seat in the courtroom that was vacant. And in fact, seated very prominently near the front of the public section of the courtroom were two teenage boys who had been in line outside at the court since about 5:30 on Sunday afternoon. Mm-hmm. in hopes of getting the seat today.
Well, let's get right to what they saw. Your blog posted immediately that the justices seemed divided along ideological lines, but Justice Kennedy took a strong view in his questioning that the Second Amendment refers to individuals. Justice Kennedy, important because he's been the swing vote. So how do you read what a final decision might be based on what you heard today?
Well, I think it is quite clear that there are five votes, and there may even be six, perhaps not only counting Justice Kennedy, but maybe in some anticipation of where he may go from here. Justice Stephen Breyer are in favor of declaring that the amendment does protect an individual's right to have a gun at home for self-defense at home. I think where the argument wound up in some kind of confusion, or certainly at a level of indistinctive resolution, is just how that homeowner is going to be able to exercise that right. What kind of a gun would they be entitled to have as a constitutional right, and what regulation, if any, could the District of Columbia government or some other level of government impose on the kind of weapon that one would use in order to legitimately and realistically be able to exercise a right of self-defense. So I think that's where, as the court deliberates between now and probably late June over how to decide this case, it doesn't seem to me that there's going to be much dispute within the court over the individual right concept, which of course would be truly a historic change in constitutional understanding.
Well, and just briefly, and we're going to continue to take a look at this with Jonathan Turley, but were, for instance, machine guns mentioned? Because that's always the catchphrase. You know, if you allow individuals to own guns, how then do you regulate, well, for instance, the ownership of a machine gun?
Yes, the machine gun problem came up repeatedly, and in fact, one of Kennedy's more successful questions with one of the counsel was when he got Alan Gura, who was representing the people challenging the District of Columbia pistol ban, to concede that it would be quite permissible to ban the interstate shipment and transfer of machine guns and sawed-off shotguns. So Mr. Gura, at several points, particularly near the end of his half hour of argument, seemed to be conceding that there would be a fairly extensive right to regulate some types of weapons, but certainly not the weapon that he says is the one most common and most commonly needed for self-defense, which is the handgun.
Lal Denniston of SCOTUSblog.com reporting on today's landmark case before the Supreme Court, observing that the justices seem to be leaning in the direction of interpreting the Second Amendment as meaning that individuals have the right to own guns. Lal, thanks so much.
Glad to be with you.
And we'll continue our analysis of today's historic debate in Washington. Also, later today, we're going to check in Northern Ireland. You want to hear that as well. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're talking about the landmark case before the Supreme Court today. The justices heard arguments in the District of Columbia versus Heller. It's a case challenging D.C.'s ban on handguns, but it is widely expected to interpret, from this court at least, what the Second Amendment means. For analysis, we want to continue with George Washington University Law Professor Jonathan Turley. Jonathan, first of all, your reaction to what we just heard, that the court seemed to be leaning towards the right of the individuals to bear arms.
Well, I'm not too surprised. The court was dealing with a problem that has remained unresolved since the beginning of this republic. But there are some liberals and some moderates, including myself, who tend to believe that the Second Amendment references an individual right of gun ownership, not because we're thrilled with the idea. But in reading the Second Amendment, it's hard not to see a strong basis for an individual right to bear arms. The real question is going to be the extent, as Lyle noted, that right can go in preventing cities and states from prohibiting certain types of weapons or ammunition or use of those things.
Well, let's talk about the strange bedfellows that have come before the court here. For instance, the White House wrote a brief asking the court not to ban the ban until there was something in place to, you know, sort of the language seemed to be, I'm roughly interpreting here, but the idea seemed to be, how do we then regulate things like machine guns? Vice President Dick Cheney, on the other hand, sided with the group bringing this case before the court, looking to uphold the interpretation of the Second Amendment as the individual's right to own guns. You say liberals were wrestling with this as well. On what grounds?
Well, actually, the Cheney thing is fascinating. I talked about that today on my blog, because I think this may be the first time that a vice president has taken that type of position, because essentially Cheney is opposing his own administration. The Justice Department put in a brief recommending a remand and strongly suggesting that restrictions could be placed on gun ownership, even if it's an individual right. Cheney joined a bunch of members of Congress in saying pretty much don't do that. Just recognize an individual right and strongly suggesting that limitations on that right would be questionable. So the court is going to have two tasks. One is a straight interpretation question. The amendment does refer to a right to bear arms, and that certainly sounds like an individual right. But it also starts with a reference to militias, and people have argued that really that wasn't just a justification of the right. That's the entire purpose,
You know what I'm going to do, Jonathan, is just jump in and remind people, you know, because this is perhaps the most tortured sentence in American history. So I'm just going to read it again so people can follow along with your analysis. It reads, a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. Continue.
Yeah, and so the real question is whether that initial phrase, a well-regulated militia being necessary to security of a free state, is a justification of the individual right to bear arms, or whether it is the sole purpose. And the district and other states have argued that's what it's all about. It's just giving the right of states to have these militias. The problem, according to the lower court, was that would effectively gut the amendment, because we don't have any militias anymore in the sense of what existed when the Second Amendment was drafted. The National Guard really isn't a militia. And they also point to many statements by framers, including John Adams in his celebrated case involving the British soldiers, where there is reference to this as a basic individual right of all Americans. So the court's first going to have to parse the language and make a decision finally, after over 200 years, whether this is one of those civil liberties. And that can really stick in the craw for liberals, you know, because liberals generally read the Bill of Rights to give it an expansive reading when it comes to the individual against the state. The Second Amendment has tended to be the exception to that. But indeed, as hard as it may seem for many liberals, the NRA may be one of the oldest civil liberties organizations in the country, if the court finds this to be an individual right.
Well, let's also remind ourselves that, you know, each side in this issue chooses a time in history to back its claim. The pro-gun position looks at the colonial period, when colonists created militias to fight the tyranny of the government, which was the British. The gun ban side, which in today's case is the D.C. government, argues that the amendment was intended to allow states to raise militias to help them put down private rebellions in a post-revolutionary period. So there's a lot of cherry-picking here as this gets debated.
No, it is. It's quite fascinating, I must say, from a constitutional standpoint. You know, the Second Amendment has always been sort of the land that time forgot. You know, every other part of the Constitution has been mauled over and picked apart and tweaked, where the Second Amendment has been left in this highly ambiguous state for so long. The Supreme Court has just avoided the question.
Well, it's still not going to answer it this time around until June. How do you think it's going to come down in the minute or so we have left? How do you think, and it's just speculation, but based on what we heard today, the court will come down as to how wide it will be? Yes, leaning toward individuals, but how much regulation of individuals' rights will the government have?
Well, I've always believed once this case was accepted that they would rule in favor of an individual right. In fact, many people criticized the District of Columbia. This was a good political move, but not a very good legal move. This is not the time or the court to have raised this question. But I think that the majority will do what the lower court did and say reasonable limitations can be placed, things like permits and qualification or eligibility requirements. And I expect that some complete bans on automatic weapons and other types of weapons or ammunition will be permissible. But the court may leave all of those or many of those questions for the lower courts to take a first whack at those before it does. That would be a traditional approach. But I expect that we will see some dicta designed to quell concerns and to say this isn't going to become the Wild West. All rights in the Constitution are subject to reasonable limitations. There's no absolute rights, and this is not going to be the first one.
Jonathan Turley, George Washington University law professor, talking about today's gun case before the Supreme Court. They seem to be leaning towards individual rights in an interpretation of the Second Amendment. Jonathan, thank you as always.
My great pleasure.
Of course, we'll continue to follow this. Still ahead today, though, we'll go inside the blog of an EMT after the news here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. At this time a year ago, a deadline was approaching. Then British Prime Minister Tony Blair was threatening to take control of Northern Ireland if rival Protestants and Catholics couldn't reach an agreement to govern their own country and end the Troubles for good. Well, the two sides met the deadline, and this week, representatives of the new government celebrated St. Patrick's Day with President George Bush at the White House. But the end of the Troubles was supposed to pay economic dividends in Northern Ireland, and the economy there still lags behind the boom times in the Republic of Ireland to the south. Well, that's an issue our next guest is watching closely. Paul Goggins serves as Britain's Minister of State for Northern Ireland. He visited our studios yesterday, and I asked him first to assess the power sharing so far.
Well, as you say, this time last year, it was dissolution or devolution, which was to give power back to local politicians in Northern Ireland. And the decision literally was made within days of St. Patrick's Day last year. Gerry Adams and Ian Paisley sat together and said devolution would happen. And in the month since then, a lot of progress has been made. All the decisions now about hospitals and schools and roads and the economy, these are all taken now in Northern Ireland by Northern Ireland politicians. And I believe there's a greater confidence coming from that amongst the people of Northern Ireland.
You mentioned the Reverend Ian Paisley, who led the Protestant majority in the fight to stay a part of Britain. Sinn Féin and the Catholic Irish Republican Army fought to force the British out of Northern Ireland, unite with the rest of Ireland. 40 years of bloodshed, 2,000 people dying. And now we see remarkable images of Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness, a former commander of the IRA, you know, sometimes walking with Martin McGuinness's hand on Ian Paisley's elbow. It's stunning to people here. Is it still stunning to people there?
It is still stunning. I think people expected in the end that the deal for devolution would be done. But to do it in that way with a lot of humanity, a lot of warmth, was something that people didn't expect. And the man who spent a political lifetime saying no finally said yes. And when he announced recently that he is to stand down in May of this year as First Minister, some of the greatest tributes he received came indeed from Sinn Féin members.
But Ian Paisley has still been adamant that power sharing is a continuation of British rule, that the Irish lost, you know, in the battle ultimately. And some see his stepping down as maybe a sign of trouble for power sharing. What are your thoughts?
I think his decision to stand down is related to the fact he's now 82 years of age, and I think he now sees it time to step aside and let others in the DUP, his party, the Democratic Unionist Party, take over, and they have a strong leadership team, and I don't see that there'll be any loss of momentum down the road of peace.
His successor is likely to be Peter Robinson, his longtime deputy. Robinson served a prison sentence for inciting violence 20 years ago. He led a mob attack on an Irish border village, but also is credited with keeping Ian Paisley at the bargaining table a year ago. So your thoughts on it perhaps being Peter Robinson who will step into those shoes?
The word from the DUP is that it will be business as usual after whoever takes over in May. It's not decided yet who'll take over, but I think they will be businesslike and they'll make sure that the progress that we've made over this last 12 months is actually built on and strengthened for the long term.
But we read that Peter Robinson has said that he's going to maintain a frostier relationship with Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA. He said not to have Paisley's warmth towards Irish officials. And Lord knows, I never thought I'd speak that sentence, but it's said that he may not have the relationship that Paisley did.
Well, I think in a time like this, when new leaders are to be elected, people will use certain language and adopt a certain style. But I strongly believe that the leadership team of the Democratic Unionist Party know that devolution is the right path, it's working, and they'll want to strengthen it and build on it.
What do you see? I mean, so power sharing is, you know, miraculously, some would say, going along. But what are some of the problems that need to be addressed?
The biggest issue that faces Northern Ireland, without doubt, is the need for new investment. In Northern Ireland, the economy is two-thirds public sector, one-third private sector, exactly the opposite as is the case in the Republic of Ireland.
Why is that? Because we know that the economy is so growing in Ireland that the Irish are leaving places like Boston when they have a choice to go there and work. So why isn't Northern Ireland having that same effect?
I think traditionally, when there were problems in Northern Ireland, the problems were bailed out by the taxpayer of the United Kingdom. Now, those days are coming to a close, and I think everybody accepts that Northern Ireland has to stand on its own feet and has to have more private sector investment, more private sector jobs.
And now the investments will be safer. I mean, obviously there was a fear of investing in a place where there was turmoil and violence.
Indeed, the whole climate has changed. It's now a peaceful climate where people are getting on with their day-to-day lives, and a private investor from anywhere in the world, but particularly from the United States, can come with confidence and know that there's a willing and able workforce there able to deliver on the investment that will come in.
What about, you know, healing wounds? I mean, healing the economy is one thing, but healing wounds, we understand there's going to be a sort of truth and reconciliation commission.
We have asked Robin Eames, the former Archbishop Eames, to head up with Dennis Bradley, a former vice chair of the policing board in Northern Ireland, to head up a commission on the past to investigate and see whether there is a consensus across the communities of Northern Ireland to see a way forward that doesn't forget the past but draws a line underneath it so that people can move on.
What do you mean by that? Will there be, as we saw in South Africa, an actual courtroom where people will be able to testify and bear witness as to what happened? Or will there be money changing hands?
I have to say it's very unlikely that we would have a South African-style Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I believe Northern Ireland will need to work out its own way of dealing with its past and the 3,000-odd unresolved murders that took place during the Troubles and all the harm and the hurt that that caused. We can't pretend that that didn't happen. It did happen. But people have to move on, and people need to rebuild their lives as families and communities. And the Eames-Bradley work is an essential first step, I think, in trying to see a way forward.
And finally, what about long-term British involvement in Northern Ireland? We heard the statement from Ian Paisley that the Protestant side in Northern Ireland sees this as a victory for British rule. And then, of course, in this country, we're watching a story unfold in Iraq, and we have a presidential candidate, John McCain, who says he sees U.S. involvement in Iraq for 100 years. Do you see British involvement in Northern Ireland forever?
Well, I see Northern Ireland remaining part of the United Kingdom, but with power devolved to the local level. So just as we have in Scotland devolved power at that level, but still Scotland is part of the United Kingdom, so we have two in Northern Ireland. And I think that gets the best of both worlds. It gives us the strategic relationship in a fast-changing and challenging world, but it also means that decisions are taken locally in a way that suits local priorities. And I believe that what's happened in this last year in Northern Ireland should give heart and hope to people around the world that problems of conflict can be overcome, and that hope can come out of what has often been a rather desperate situation.
I just have to note, you mentioned Scotland, and we have guests from Scotland who speak about wanting to separate from Britain.
I don't believe the people of Scotland actually want to separate themselves out. Some politicians do. But it's very important, I think, that Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland stay with England as part of the United Kingdom to make us a strong partner in many of the challenges that we face.
Paul Goggins serves as the British government's Minister of State for Northern Ireland. Thanks for coming to our studio to visit with us.
It's a pleasure.
Okay, a quick look ahead at stories in the works. 5 years after the fall of Saddam Hussein, we'll hear voices from Iraq, including a member of parliament and an American officer who just lost 5 comrades. Also, is it a recession? Well, a small business owner says people are into fixing old things instead of buying new ones. That's in the week ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. On on the outskirts of Los Angeles, underneath a highway overpass, you'll find Bob Baker's Marionette Theater. It's the longest-running marionette theater in America. 84-year-old master puppeteer Bob Baker has kept the theater alive for more than half his life. Today, the place is run down, and Baker doesn't have enough money to fix it up. But as producer Quina Kim explains, the theater is a relic and a monument to puppetry.
It's hard to imagine it now, but in the 1930s, there were dozens of puppet theaters here in Los Angeles. There was no TV, and you might go to a movie once a week. But to fill in the time in between, people would go see puppeteers like Bob Baker. Would you mind showing me how puppets move?
This is the main part of the control, which holds his head. We have a string here that picks up his cane, and then he taps.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Bob Baker Marionette Theater!
You have to want to feel what you're doing. You want to be able to feel that you're dancing. You want to feel that you're acting, and you just can't pretend you're wiggling a string. You're a cat tap dancing in a number.
You have to inhabit the puppet.
You got it. You inhabit the puppet.
I want for you guys to sit back, relax, have a great time as we present Bob Baker's Marionette Show.
I drove by for 15 years and never went in here. I was imagining like little lamb chop sock puppets or whatever, and I thought, you know, don't know if I need to see that.
Pop culture historian Charles Phoenix.
Then finally I'm like, no, I've got to go in there. So I came into the theater, and I couldn't believe what I saw.
The hat I got for Christmas is too big. It's nice, but my sombrero is too big. Is it raining? Is it snowing? I can't see where I am going.
One of those places when you walk in the door, you go like, what decade am I in? So it's a form of time travel in a way.
Oh my goodness. This is like a huge room filled with tapes and records.
See, each show has its own 78 or a 33, or I can use the newer CDs. And we didn't have sophisticated sound in those days. We had a big speaker, and we said it was high fidelity. It was just louder than the others. And I remember we used to, early day, we put on the recording of Jealousy, have it up loud, and you hear those violins, hear those strings. I was interested in show business even as a very young boy. I was taking dancing and tap dancing and Russian dancing and piano and acting all at the same time, but I never could get the kids in the neighborhood together to put on a show, so I was able to build my puppets and do a show. Bullocks Wilshire called me when I was 8, sent me out to a home in Beverly Hills, and I did a puppet show for them for a birthday party, and it was the height of depression. They paid me a whole $15 for the show, and that was more than some people got all week. And I went back to Bullocks Wilshire, and I said, send me out on as many shows as you want to. I'm ready to go. I worked in 2 nightclubs, but I had to go in and out the back door because I was underage.
How old were you?
I was between the ages of about 14, 15.
Do you remember one of the puppet scenes that you did at the bar that was adult, but maybe not too adult so that we can air it on the radio?
Don't worry, it's quite suitable for the children. This is a story about passion, bloodshed, desire, and death.
One of the things we did, they were smoking hashish.
So the puppets were smoking hashish?
Yeah, they were smoking this stuff and supposedly having these wild dreams.
What were some of the wild dreams?
Well, they had dancing girls, and they did a little nudist thing, and, they kind of a love scenario. And
come in, Pauline, three ladies of the boulevard.
They would pick names of people who were in the audience. Then they would call these names out and use them as the characters, you know.
Do you see puppetry going on, or is it an old form of entertainment that's going to start fading away?
It will never fade away. It'll come in various forms, different forms. It will go on, because man always liked to create in his image.
Master puppeteer Bob Baker, our story was produced by Quina Kim. Coming up, inside the blog of an emergency medical technician in 1 minute, here and now.
Come in, call it, Vivi.
Jay Weaver has been a paramedic with Boston Emergency Medical Services for 22 years, but he's also an author of sorts. His blog is called Other People's Emergencies, Random Thoughts of an Urban Paramedic. It's had over 83,000 hits. Well, Jay earned his law degree while he was working as an EMT, and he recently took a leave from his job to go on active duty with the U.S. Army Reserves. He's in Virginia now, preparing to be a judge advocate general for the U.S. military. But we spoke with Jay before he left about being on the front line of emergency care, saving lives, and often watching lives pass right before his very eyes. He began with a story about a young man on Boston's Tobin Bridge.
That one happened on a Christmas Eve. The man had just earlier that evening been told by his wife of only 1 month that she was leaving him. And that was just too much for him to take. And so he went out and he drank quite a bit. And so he went up onto the bridge. And he was getting ready to jump when he saw a police car coming along. And so he kind of hid underneath the bridge until the police car passed, not knowing that we were going to be following along right afterward. When he saw us, he climbed onto the outside of the railing and he just held on very precariously, you know, just kind of by his fingertips. And he just hung there for a minute. I did the best that I could to just keep him talking because I figured the longer we engaged him in conversation, the more we could divert his attention from what he had intended to do. Eventually, they reached a point in the conversation where I'll never forget this because I thought it was a terribly nice thing for him to do. He pointed to each of us in turn, to me and then to my partner and then to the police officer who had since circled around and come back. And he said, "It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault, but I'm going." And he turned and he jumped. And we all rushed over to the edge, but of course we couldn't possibly get to him in time to do him any good. And we all just had to watch helplessly as he just dropped 300 some odd feet into the water, and we saw him hit. And for a minute, none of us could do anything. As experienced as we were, we couldn't move because it was the first time that any of the three of us had seen someone commit suicide right in front of our eyes. And then, of course, everything kicked in, and we got on the radio, and we launched a search. Unfortunately, his body was discovered by a fisherman a couple of days later.
What a nightmare for you.
That was the first time that a call ever bothered me enough to actually stick with me subconsciously.
But there was a lot that did bother you. You write about a woman in cardiac arrest, and I think the writing was a futile effort to try to save her. She was just as dead at the end of the effort as she was at the beginning. There's a lot of futility in being an emergency technician.
Sure there is. Not long ago, we had a woman who had overdosed on heroin right in front of her own five kids after we woke her up with the antidote to the medication. She refused to tell us where the dirty needle was. We wanted to just get the needle out of the house because there were little kids around, and she refused to tell us where it was, absolutely refused to cooperate. When we had arrived, she wasn't breathing. I mean, she was on the verge of death. We gave her the medication that was necessary. We woke her up. We breathed for her until she was able to breathe on her own. She was discharged from the hospital later on, good as new. Later on in that same shift, we were called to treat someone who had just suddenly died from a heart problem. It was an elderly person who had been married for close to 50 years. Her spouse was absolutely heartbroken. I remember watching him just sobbing. I walked away from the emergency room that night thinking to myself, you know, I'm not supposed to think this way. But it just doesn't seem right. It seems to me that we saved the wrong person on this night.
You mentioned the heroin addict. You write in your blog about how paramedics really can see what kind of drug is moving through the streets.
Certainly, certainly. Yeah. We'll have these almost like epidemics of heroin overdoses where we'll have a bunch of them in a single shift for every shift, sometimes for a week or more. And that's when we know that somewhere out on the street, some batch is a little bit too potent.
Well, you also say that there are people who just shouldn't use 911. It's used so inappropriately. Somebody, I think I read, called to tell you that somebody was sleeping on a bench.
I say that somewhat facetiously. I hope people don't actually interpret that to mean that I believe that some people should be prohibited from calling 911. But we do receive an awful lot of calls for things that clearly are not emergencies. Even in the amount of time that I've been working in the field, I've seen a big change in this area where more and more people call an ambulance simply because they need a ride, not because they have any kind of an emergency.
There's a really sweet post on your blog called Learning About Healthcare. It's about a mother who called you when her daughter had a cough, and she called you about cough medicine or something. You ended up talking to her about how to use the emergency system.
Yeah, and I ended up getting kind of an education as a result of that.
What'd you learn from her?
What I learned from her was that I was very naive. This particular call that you're talking about occurred when I was still fairly new to the business and fairly new to working in Boston. I didn't know the first thing about what it was like to live in poverty. In this particular case, the woman was a very young mother, and she called the ambulance at about 10 o'clock at night because her daughter had had a cough for 2 weeks. She decided, well, it's time to get some cough medicine. And so she did what many other people in poor urban neighborhoods do. She picked up the phone and called 911, and an ambulance came. And she said she wanted to go to the hospital to get some cough medicine for her daughter. Again, being so naive, this was a foreign concept to me. I thought that I was going to teach her a lesson. I said, you know, you realize that this isn't really an emergency. Somebody who's been coughing for 2 weeks, that's not an emergency. And she said, yeah, I know. Just take me to the hospital. We were about halfway to the hospital, and a call went out for a shooting. Someone had been shot in the back, right up the street from where she lived. And I said, you see that? Somebody just got shot, and now they're going to have to wait a lot longer for an ambulance because you've tied us up going to the hospital to get cough medicine. And she said, yeah, whatever. It's none of your business. Mind your own business. And we continued on to the hospital. It wasn't until after the call was over that it suddenly occurred to me that I didn't teach her anything. She knew perfectly well how the system works.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, that one of the reasons she probably didn't want to walk to the hospital is that people get shot on her street.
I'm sure that was a consideration, absolutely.
So how do you feel about that woman, though? Do you think she's trapped, or is she abusing the system, or?
There are people who simply don't have any choice. On the other hand, there are people who truly have either a sense of entitlement or a complete lack of understanding of how the system is supposed to operate.
A lot of frustrations, but also a lot of successes. Just if you could, the images that float up to your mind, and you've talked about them in your blog, some of those successes.
You know, I've seen babies die, but I've also seen babies born. I've seen people who could not be saved, but I've also seen people brought back from the dead.
Have you brought someone back from the dead?
Absolutely, absolutely. Everybody I work with has. You know, everybody who works as an EMT or as a paramedic at one point or another, they have the opportunity to save someone's life. That's one of the reasons that people go into that line of work.
We have terrible violence here in the city, in Boston, as do other cities, Philadelphia, others we've talked of. A lot of gang violence, a lot of promising young people, you know, gun deaths. And you are one of the people, I'm sure, who has to pick them up.
We had a case where there was a difference of opinion over which gang was the better gang. And one gang member shot the other gang member in the back and put him in a wheelchair permanently. He's paralyzed for life. Clearly, the person who pulled out that gun and pulled the trigger wasn't thinking about those kinds of things when he did it. All he thought of was, I've been insulted and I'll show you. And that's the kind of mentality that I think is driving this kind of violence.
And you were on the front lines, Jay Weaver, 22 years as a paramedic here in the Boston area. Now I understand that you've enrolled in a program that's going to allow you to be a JAG, a lawyer for the military. Why?
Well, I've always respected anyone who has served in the military. After doing the same kind of work for 22 years, you begin feeling like everything is just all the same over and over again.
Burned out? A little burned out?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question about that. But it's more about the challenge. It's no longer feeling to me like it's as challenging as it once was. And I needed something new to keep myself motivated. And so I went back to college while I was working, and I went to law school while I was working. And I just recently was commissioned as an officer in the Army's Judge Advocate General Corps. And with my healthcare background, it looks like I'll probably be doing a lot of work with wounded soldiers who come back from Iraq and Afghanistan and perhaps aren't getting the benefits they deserve.
Jay Weaver, we'll link you to his blog at our website, here-now.org. Jay, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Robin.